Welcome to an action-packed Gridiron Show. So much to cram in today. It's been the first Wembley weekend, and we had a game. Not a lot else to say about it, but a lot of fallout from that game, so we've got to talk all about that. Some intriguing Monday night football, some great week four action, and a fantastic guest in the studio. What more could you ask for, listeners? This is the Gridiron Show. I already feel like I sound tired, Paolo Bandini.
I can't imagine that that's accurate, given the beautiful energy drink that you're supping on as we get ready to record here.
This is indeed the Gridiron Show, brought to you by Sports Travel Tours. Sports Travel for sports fans, by sports fans. Go to their website, sportstraveltours.com. If you ever want to do any travelling, it's a fantastic way to do it, because you just get a much, much better experience than trying to do it off your own back. And check out all our stuff at gridiron-magazine.com. Loads of great content up there for you. I reference Paolo Bandini. He is our man in the studio. He's joining me this week. Ollie was meant to be in the studio with us as well, but has gone genuinely AWOL. We're recording this. It's about kind of 9:45 on Tuesday morning. Rare that we do a recording on a Tuesday. And Ollie was keen on doing the morning recording, because he's got to be in town today anyway. And he watched the late game, and we were Facebooking about it and chatting about the play. And he may have gone to bed and not managed to wake up.
Should we be here, or should we be out searching?
Probably out searching, but I quite like the... Well, I don't like the idea he's going to miss his meeting. That sounds mean, but I quite like the idea he's just marauding and wandering the streets looking for us. Paolo referenced the energy drink. He has brought me something. I asked for an energy drink because I haven't been to bed yet from the night shift, and he has brought me something called a Tornado Energy. Mm-hmm. It's 89p as an introductory price, and the ring pull on the top, I mean, best represents something that's like an airlock from a 70s Ridley Scott film. I don't actually understand how it works. I have already half opened it, and all that's happened is it's kind of pulled a flap on one side. A couple of bits of plastic have broken, but there's still no actual hole in the top. Oh, my God, what? So, I've pulled the one side up. I'm going to have to tweet out photos so people understand. And then, to get to the hole, it slides back.
Wow.
Look at that.
Wow.
That's far too fancy an opening for a can. Let's taste it. This is great radio. Do you know what? That's not too bad. Yeah? That's pretty tasty.
If the price went up from the introductory price to, I don't know, maybe, you know, 94p, 95p, you think you'd stick with it?
Anything under a quid, then I'm all in. Other than that, I'm looking for the deal. I'm not going
to
lie.
Do you know, someone was talking to me about this the other day, with branding of products. We're just going way off topic now, but that happens.
It's fine. you've listened to the show before.
Exactly. people will psychologically have maximum amounts they're willing to spend on things. So, like, packets of crisps in a pub, people will spend £1 on a packet of crisps, and after that, that's too
not
much.
Acceptable. Yeah. £1.05, not yeah. acceptable.
So what sort of the companies have had to do over time is continue to sell for £1, but gradually make the packet smaller, because that's people will accept that, because it's still £1 for a packet of crisps. But as soon as that packet is more than £1, no more crisps.
This is great banter.
That's the first time I've dropped that this whole season. So there is so much to cram into today's show. I'm not going to lie, the week four games. We talked about it not being a great slate of games in our preview show, but actually it did end up being. There were some great games in there, and so we will get to them and talk about them, but we're probably going to do that in a very truncated version, doing just a minute or two on each of the games. But there were a couple of main games that we definitely need to talk about. I want to talk about last night's Monday Night Football, the dreadful referee decision, whether or not the Seahawks are in trouble considering they're going to see the Bengals next week. We're going to cram all that in. We've got our locker room interviews, post-Jets-Dolphins games. We've got our old friends Greg Jennings and Olivia Vernon joining us, and a whole raft of players off that Jets defense. Liam Blackburn literally went nuts in that locker room and spoke to anyone that he could get his hands on. So we've got a load of great audio coming for you, plus the managing director of NFL UK, Alistair Kirkwood, talking to us about the future of the game in the UK. Funnily enough, the same thing he always talks to us about. But there's a few nice little nuggets in there, so we'll work all that in as well. And let's start off with the early game on Sunday. Jets against the Dolphins at Wembley. The build-up was palpable. We were so excited about it. And then it ended up being a little bit of a rout. There was a comeback in the fourth quarter, but Chris Ivory ran for 166 yards and a touchdown. Ryan Fitzpatrick threw for 218 and another score as the Jets took a 27-14 win over the Dolphins at Wembley Stadium, which has resulted in the firing of Joe Philbin. For the second consecutive season, a head coach has left after week four and been immediately fired. We want to talk about the game and break down the game itself and why we think what's happened happened. Should we start off by hearing from the players in the locker room and getting the Miami reaction to what happened? So I'll start with Olivia Vernon. Now, this defence we talked about up until this game, they've only got the single sack now through four games. I actually recorded that they got one this weekend, but apparently it didn't count when Fitzpatrick fell back on the ball. I thought they'd actually managed to get hands on him then, but apparently not officially recorded as a sack. So even that default sack that they got didn't count. So let's first hear from Olivia Vernon on the defensive side of the ball and then from Greg Jennings.
So first of all, tough loss going 1-3. It's got to be a difficult situation to be in right now.
Yeah, you know, when you lose a game like that, it's always going to be difficult, but it's all about bouncing back and responding, seeing what type of team we are.
There's been a lot of onus on the defense, a lot of money spent on that line. I mean, already a lot of talent there with you guys, and yet, where do you think the issues are coming from this defensive line?
I mean, teams are, they're going to scheme up against us, but that's not no excuse at all. We just got to go out there and play, you know. If we can't stop the run, then we're not going to be able to get to the quarterback, point blank. So we got to stop the run, keep doing what we're doing, and force him to throw.
On that point, Chris Ivory had a huge day today against you guys. I hate to keep focusing on the negatives, but were there not adjustments there that you could have made in the second half? Did you feel were the right calls being made to try and adjust against that?
I mean, yeah, I feel like we played way better in the second half, to be honest with you. You know, stopping them on third, going a whole bunch of three and outs. I feel like we should have just started a little faster as a team overall. That's on us. You know, we got to just start faster.
And when you guys get the turnover and the interception, which you suggest is a pressure turnover, it's all about putting that pressure on the quarterback and him making the bad throw. How frustrating is it then that that's not then turned into at least a gain, no points, and it's just back on you to get back on the field again?
Hey, that's what we get paid to do. We get paid to go back on defense and make more plays. That's what we get paid to do.
Been a lot of talk about the coaching around here. Obviously, do you think the pressure is on Joe after today's game?
Honestly, I don't even pay attention to that. I know as a team and as a coaching staff, we're just trying to win these games. That's all.
And with 2 weeks now to your next game, obviously we've just come off the loss. You need time to go away and assess. But what do you think this organization needs to do to get back to winning ways? So much hope going into the season, wasn't there?
We just got to start fast and play Miami football, play what we normally do, and come out there and show teams what we got and win these games. You know, no excuses. We just got to go out there and win.
I love the talent on your unit. I hope it does improve for you, pal.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Talented defensive end Olivia Vernon there, and we'll talk a bit about that unit in a minute and their struggles. But before we do so, let's speak with a man. Well, another man, in fact, because we spoke with both of these guys in the past, but another man that we spoke with very recently on the podcast in Greg Jennings. I, of course, reminded him of that at the very beginning of the interview. And I like that in the middle of this interview at some point, he pays me a little compliment. Listen out for it. He was clearly devastated with the loss and, you know, much more softly spoken than we've heard before, but also very honest about the quality of the team, what they were doing, the quality in all three phases. And obviously, as a veteran guy who knows Joe Philbin well, was very honest about the whole situation. So I really enjoyed this one. I hope you do too.
So first of all, obviously, as we spoke before, you had success last time you were over here. How's it feel like to be on the other side of the ball today?
No one likes this feeling. Obviously, as competitors, everyone wants to win. Everyone wants to put forth a great performance. But obviously, they play better than what we did today. And we gotta look at ourselves in the mirror and identify what our issues are and solve them. And solve them quick.
There seemed to be a couple of times that you were open in the back of the end zone. We saw a couple of throws over the top to you, one maybe slightly overthrown, one where, I don't know, was it a timing issue? Why did we? I thought you could be open. I thought those were possible touchdowns.
I mean, there's a lot of things that we can look at throughout the game that took place, but, you know, when you're, you know, as a receiver, you never really see what a quarterback goes through. And given situations, being on the sideline and being able to watch the duress that a quarterback is under, I mean, they went cover zero, like, all game. And it's like you're trying to be accurate. You want to be perfect, but you can't, because you find yourself on the ground, and there's just not that chemistry there that just happens. And it, you know, today was one of those days where they brought the house 80% of the time, and we couldn't respond. We didn't do enough. We didn't make enough plays.
How frustrating is it? It looks like you are coming back into the game, and then we see the touchback called back for that pick play. What was your view of that play?
You know,
I can tell you the press box was on your side, if it matters.
I mean, 10 years in, I don't think I've ever seen a pick play called, pick or whatever they called, down in the red zone. But, you know, the refs are going to call what they see. They're improving every game just like we are. And it was a play that we didn't overcome, and that's on us.
And what about the play calling? I mean, two minute warning just coming up to that. We thought maybe they'll go for something over the middle here. We know the clock's going to stop anyway. Ball goes to the outside. It seemed like that was possibly a bad decision, to be honest.
I like this guy, though. You know, it's regardless of what the play calls are, we have to make plays. And, you know, we've talked about that amongst ourselves. It doesn't matter what the play call is, we have to make it work. And if we're making it work, we get the play calling confidence to call any play in our Rolodex. And that's the way we have to go out there and play. And if a play doesn't work, line up and run the next play and make it work. So it's not a finger pointing issue. It's one of those things, like I said, we have to make things work. We have to make plays from top, bottom.
I know we've just literally come off the loss. We've not maybe had time to process it, but where do the Dolphins go from here? The bye week is going to be a long 2 weeks before that next game.
Well, this is the worst time to have a loss, because you have too long of time to like sit and just ponder about what went wrong and what needs to be fixed. It's always better to go into a bye week on a win, but we didn't do that, so now we have ample time to kind of self-assess as individuals, as collectively, as a team, to see where we are, who we are, and where we really truly desire to go. And, you know, we know what everybody wants, but it's about putting the pieces together and making it happen on the field on Sundays.
Thank you, Greg. Absolutely.
Questions already about Joe Philbin. This is going to amplify that even more. How much responsibility are the players taking for that situation right now?
You know, players win ball games. Coaches coach. You know, and for me, it's. I feel like the onus is on us as players. We can't go out there and not perform and then try to pass the buck on someone else. That's not who we are. That's not what we are as a team, as an organization. We're together. You know, whether we're up, down, we're together as a team. And that's coaches, players alike. And everyone within the organization, for that matter.
As a player with your experience, can he survive this as a coach, do you feel?
Yeah, I think anything is able to be survived. But that's not for me to even put my two cents in. I just know that we have to do something to get better for our next opponent coming up after the bye.
Thanks, Greg. Thank
you. Appreciate that.
So just to give a quick credit there, that's Mike White you heard asking those last couple of questions there from BBC. It's actually he who'll be speaking to Alistair Kirkwood in a short while. Greg Jennings, starkly honest, just like he was on the podcast last week about the quality of all three phases for the Miami team. And interestingly, as a guy who knew Joe Philbin from his time in Green Bay, and certainly all the Green Bay media have been sticking up for Joe Philbin as being a great guy and a great assistant and everything else. But we were in those press conferences afterwards. We saw, you know, Ryan Tannehill get asked by Matt Sherry, does he think he's been put in the best position? Mm-hmm. And yes, everyone gave their platitudes and said, you know, I feel the coaches. There was just a general atmosphere that they were going to fly home and he was out of the door.
Yeah, I think the only person who seemed to not get that was Joe Philbin, who at his press conference was absolutely going to be back at work on Monday and doing all the things that he needs to do to turn around this team. You know, the thing about him being a good guy, that seems to be absolutely everyone who gets to spend good amounts of time with him. I noticed that the Miami Herald even had in amongst various pieces ripping him apart for things he'd done wrong. There was an editorial this morning. You know, sometimes nice guys do finish last, but unfortunately, being a nice guy doesn't qualify you to be a good NFL head coach, and he hasn't been. And I think that there was something especially painful in his reaction to it. Not just that he didn't think he was getting fired, when I think a lot of us thought that was very, very probable, but this idea that he, when he was talked about, can it be turned around, what can be done? Well, you know, but we shook some things up in team meetings this week. We did our video sessions a little bit differently, and you're like...
And I was amazed. Tannehill was talking about how there's leaders in the locker room. We saw Ndamukong Suh's interview where he basically stood there and said that he wouldn't answer most of the questions, and the ones he did answer, he didn't answer very curtly. We actually saw him. I just finished speaking to Greg Jennings, and we actually, me and Sherry, tried to grab a couple of minutes with Mike Tannenbaum, but... he pied us off, basically. We thanked him for doing the interview before, and it was lovely, but we walked past Sue as he was leaving his press conference, and the man didn't look like he had a care in the world. He was honestly strutting down the hallway of Wembley like they'd just won a 30-point destruction. It was genuinely like he knew Philbin was going, and that was what he wanted to happen. There were so many issues on Sunday that to pick each of them apart, but... starting off with the play calling, just dreadful beginning to end.
Yeah, well, obviously, Simon Clancy, I don't know if we might have something from later, he was in the press conference afterwards asking Philbin about these fade patterns, just running fade pattern, fade pattern, fade pattern, and same thing, same result, you know, not going anywhere. Absolute failure to establish the running game yet again, which is just a travesty when you've got, you know, I think it was the second play from scrimmage. Lamar Miller came through the line, made a decent 13-yard gain first down. You think, okay, you know, maybe some lessons have been learned here, and we're going to see the Dolphins establish the running game and get some offensive balance. But no, that went out the window immediately. Tannehill saying in the press conference afterwards, oh, well, you know, you can't run the ball when you're behind. That's nonsense.
They were behind two scores.
Yeah.
That was the most at most times. You know, it wasn't like you were behind big. And yes, to get back into the game when you're two scores down in the first half, you had to rely on a couple of big penalties called against you when finally you threw the ball downfield. But if you're not establishing the run, and then you're on every first down, they seem to be going play action.
Yep.
You know, until the penalty, they'd only had one first down in their first four drives. And other than that...
which was the Lamar Miller run.
Yeah. and so all of that play calling was terrible. And then to kind of cap it off, they get into the fourth quarter. They're two scores down. They drive down the field. They get eight shots in the red zone. Now, admittedly, I think the pick play was unfair. I think sometimes when Greg Jennings said it in the interview there, he's never seen a pick play called in the red zone like that, because the fact of the matter is that you're going to be more compressed. It's more likely players are going to naturally clash with each other. I think it looked purely accidental, and it was harsh. They probably should have had the touchdown, at which point there's 6 points in it. That's a fantastic position to be in. But they didn't help themselves by not just punching the ball in. You're on the 2 yard line.
Yeah.
Like, run it. Run the ball. For Christ's sake, stop running fades to the back end to Greg Jennings, who I asked about those throws and asked, did he think he was given the best chance to catch them? And he gave quite a kind of nondescript, slightly off answer, which suggested that he didn't think it was the right play calling either.
Yeah. But you know, the play calling is an element of it. And the other question that's sort of being just raised, and is a horrible one to contemplate for Miami, given that they've just handed him a $90 million, well, more than $90 million, I can't remember exactly what the number is, dollar contract, is that, you know, there's a slight impression that Tannehill isn't very popular there at the moment either, and there's been these reports coming out about practice sessions and him having
Simon Clancy is absolutely determined that's not true. He's like, that's not Tannehill's way. He's got some friends on the inside who have told him that definitely didn't happen. It's just one reporter trying to stir it up. But certainly at a time when you're going through turmoil, you don't need that around the team.
Absolutely.
And you need your leaders to be coming out and leading. And there was the other play that really stood out for me from the game, and we spoke about this a lot on the day, was coming up to the 2 minute drill. You've managed to get down to the 30, you're still two scores down, but you know if you go down, you score a touchdown here, you've got a chance.
Something, yeah.
They've 4 or 5 seconds left. They've gone to the outside every time because they're trying to run the clock down. They've left the middle completely open. Bailey's got single coverage on the outside to Cameron, but has clearly got the better of him. Mm-hmm. Attack over the middle, because the clock is going to stop anyway. Yeah. It's basics.
Yeah.
It's the most basic part of the game, and instead they try and throw to the corner to Cameron. Mm-hmm. It's an incompletion way over his head, mm-hmm. and you end up in a third and long, difficult situation. That's when you end up going out of the game, and that's where it's finally lost. And it was just so much frustration watching, not even as a Dolphins fan, just, you know, knowing that there were Dolphins fans having to suffer through that.
Well, you know, it was frustrating because I think, you know, ultimately what all of us want when we go and see these games is to see good games of football that will get the fans in London excited, that will make people think, you know, make more people want to come to the sport, make people who do come to the sport feel like they're getting their money's worth for what aren't cheap tickets at Wembley. You know, I think it was hard to unpick because I didn't think Tannehill, in general terms, threw the ball very well, made good decisions. On the other hand, it's hard to unpick that from the fact that he constantly had players in his face. And actually, the first touchdown pass, I thought was a really nice throw. You're right, they'd gone the entire field on two penalties, but the actual touchdown itself had a defender in his face, had a, you know, basically just set his feet and lofted the ball over the back corner of the end zone. So there were little glimpses of this quarterback who he's supposed to be, which is, you know, not Dan Marino, but the best Dolphins quarterback since Dan Marino, which is, you know, a significant period of time now. And you know, this is the question that we're ultimately going to have to ask. And I'm sure we'll see better days ahead from Sue than we saw this week, getting pushed around by a guard who'd never played in the NFL before. But really, all that money spent on bringing him in, couldn't that have been better spent doing something more to protect your quarterback?
Yeah, absolutely. Offensive line's clearly an issue. I think that left side of the line as well, and we'll get onto how good the Jets played it defensively and schemed it in a moment. But that defensive front, Sue, Wake, Mitchell, Vernon, none of them have got a sack yet this season. Yep. They're meant to be one of the best lines in the league. They definitely need to get some pressures, and the Jets showed them how it was done this week. And, you know, the Jets line isn't brilliant. Fitzpatrick got plenty of time, but it felt like he was never under that much pressure. He had to make two or three throws under pressure, and when he did, he tended to throw it to the sidelines, either get it out of bounds or occasionally make a play. Mm-hmm. Fine, that's great.
Yeah, and you know, that's what Ryan Fitzpatrick is. He's a smart quarterback who's nothing special, but knows he's nothing special, and therefore makes good decisions. And I think I think I've completely lost my thread is what I think. It can't have been that important.
I think you're right. I think Fitzpatrick is the kind of guy who makes those sorts of plays. Let's talk about the Dolphins. Clearly need a reset. They're playing Tennessee in 2 weeks. We know that Dan Campbell's in there. We don't know a huge amount about him yet, and we'll speak to Simon Clancy later this week, I assure you, and get some more inside thought on him. From what we understand, he's very liked by the players, very liked by the staff, and is a bit more rah-rah bombastic, gets the people G'd up, which is maybe what they need. I really fancied Jim Schwartz going in there and taking over as interim head coach, as was mentioned by a couple of different reporters. He's obviously worked with Sue before. He's obviously great at getting defenses going, playing different blitz schemes, getting fronts working. I think he would have been a really interesting choice, even though I dislike the man immensely. But they've gone with Dan Campbell, and it's going to be a big 2 weeks for them.
Yeah, that was the thought I was going to come to, was, you know, we've got the Dolphins have moved on from Philbin, but they haven't moved on from Kevin Coyle. And really, that's this fundamental issue for the defense. Sue clearly not too chuffed about having to play two gaps the whole time. He's much happier being able to penetrate and be disruptive. And frankly, if you're going to spend that money on him, why not? You know, I always say this whenever you, any sport, which is a team sport, if you're signing someone for a lot of money, then really what you should be thinking about, how do I put this person in the best position to do what he does best? And what Sue does best is penetrate and cause disruption.
If you spent $60 million guaranteed on a quarterback, which is what the sort of money these big guys are getting, then you'd expect them to run the offense that suited that quarterback.
Exactly.
It doesn't necessarily happen in San Francisco, admittedly. I'm not bitter. I promise I'm not bitter. Let's listen to the Jets then, and let's hear what they've got to say. Liam Blackburn did a fantastic job going in and getting some interviews with those guys. And I think we started off with defensive lineman. I think I throw to it myself, in fact, so I'm just going to leave myself to throw to Liam Blackburn. Liam seemed to have a lot of fun in the Jets locker room yesterday. I mean, that's no real surprise coming off the back of that big win. And he spoke to defensive players. He got some great interviews. And let's kick things off with a guy who got a lot of snaps in the game, actually. Came in as a replacement. A lot of line rotation coming from that Jets defense. And it's great to hear from one of the players who had so much disruptive force in this game. This is Ledger Doosable.
First off, so you got the Manchester City shirt this week and the message from Sergio Aguero. Did you see what happened yesterday?
Yeah, 5 goals. The man is amazing, man. So, you know, they won yesterday. I feel like I had to come out here and do my part and show out a little bit like he did yesterday.
Did you watch the game?
I watched part of it. I was actually supposed to be at the game, but the ride from our hotel was like 3 hours. I wouldn't have been able to go and come back and make it to our meeting in time. But I'm glad that Serge had an amazing game, especially after he wished us good luck. It's an amazing feeling.
Great stuff. And in terms of the whole experience, I guess it's always better when you're coming away with the W.
Oh, definitely. When you come away with the win, everything feels a lot better.
And the big game, AFC Chiefs rivalry, obviously you now go 3-1 Dolphins drop to 1-3. It was key that you got the win, wasn't it?
Definitely. It's a divisional game, so we're 1-0 in the division, which is the most important thing. You know, we have the bye week coming up, so we're going to be able to rest and get some players back off of injury. So it's overall a great feeling.
And obviously the defense stepped up when it mattered towards the end. It was getting close. What was it like out there?
It was way too exciting. It didn't need to be that exciting, but it was good. We have some great defensive backs, and they were able to get turnovers at the end and close out the game, thank God.
Well, I guess as well, when you know you took 11 turnovers in the first 3 weeks, and to get another couple of takeaways today, this unit's really coming up big, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. We pride ourselves on getting turnovers, and that's what we did today. That's what we did the first 2 weeks. We didn't get as many as we needed to last week, but this defense is prided on stopping the run and getting turnovers.
Sorry. Well, obviously you had the injuries as well, and managed to come through them well.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, we have the bye this week, and it'll be good to get some of those players back coming off the bye.
Just finally for me, what are your plans for the bye? Any going away anywhere or just rest?
I'm just rest, man. Rest and relax, man, and refocus and get ready for this long stretch that we have.
Ledger Doosable, great stuff there. Still got Deion Bailey to come, but let's hear now from a couple of other guys who play in the backfield. It'll be Calvin Pryor in a moment, coming off the back of that injury earlier today. Liam will ask him about that. But let's start off with Antonio Cromartie. And Liam began by asking how the defensive coordinator's knowledge from his time in Miami gave them a little bit of an edge today against the Dolphins.
Well, it was big. Coming from a guy that was there last year, understanding the offense. But, you know, I think what we really tried to do was try to key in on our keys. And we knew what kind of offense we was trying to face. The offensive coordinator came from Philly. So we were thinking it was going to get more similar route combination to runs from that standpoint. We had a little more of a mobile quarterback, but he didn't pull the ball and try to run. So we felt like we was going to try to get that kind of offense, and you know, we just make sure that we didn't make the same mistakes that we did from last week.
The Bills in general like to blitz him a lot. You guys were selective with the blitzes today.
I mean, it's just a point of applying pressure. We felt like if we got him off his key, he wasn't going to be able to throw the ball like he really wanted to. I think that's what we tried to do. I think the biggest thing we had to do was just try to clean up our chemistry. We had 6 in the first half, 8 in the second half. You know, and I can count for one of them. I just wanted to make sure that we just play what we see and make sure we just run into those.
You mentioned the fans. What were your experiences there? Was it like a normal Dolphins home game?
But you know what? The fans were great. I mean, the experience here, the fans, everything. I mean, it was great. It was very into the game. And you have a crowd, you don't know which side is going up. It's just excited for the plays, and that's what it's really all about. The experience has been tremendous here for the days that we've been here. It's actually been better than the first time I came here for a four-horn entire week back in 2008.
You mentioned the defense. In terms of this unit, you were obviously in the team that went to back-to-back AFC Championship games. You lead the league in takeaways now. Is this defense better than the one that went to the two Championship games?
No, I don't know. It's too early. It's too early to tell. No, I think we're doing a great job of getting turnovers. From that standpoint, that's our focal point, getting off the field on third down and, you know, trying to get turnovers. So, I mean, I think from that standpoint, we're doing a great job. You know, guys are doing their job. It's a more veteran type team on the defense side of the ball. And it's just going out and going to play football.
First off, we saw you come off of that injury. How are you feeling?
I'm good.
I guess the bye week's coming at a good time.
It's perfect timing for the bye week, you know. Pretty sure got a lot of guys are hurting like myself and trying to get rested up, you know, so because it's a long season.
And obviously the defense came out big today. You led the league before this game, and another few takeaways again. It really was good.
Oh, no doubt about it, man. That's what we feed off of. We have to create turnovers and, you know, make things tough for our opponents. So if we can continue to do that, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, there's a chance we can win a lot of ball games, but it just has to be week by week.
How about yourself? Because obviously you're coming into your second year now. You thinking that you can make a big leap this year with a year under your belt of the experience?
I'm just taking it one game at a time, man. It's always good to have a year under your belt, but in practice I'm just preparing the right way so I can go out and execute in the game. You know, my teammates, you know, they need me to play my role as best as I can, so that's what I'm trying to do.
In terms of the secondary this year, you've got Rivas and Cromartie and Scrying all alongside you as well. That unit started really well.
Yeah, those guys, but I have Marcus Gilchrist as well, you know. He's been a big help. You know, he's very versatile, like myself, you know. So we both able to do a lot of things out there and help each other out.
And the big win over an AFC East rival going into the bye as well, that's massive for the division, isn't it?
Oh, that's huge. The start I want to know in our division, you know, that was a big key win. You know, we just have to stay focused and keep the ball rolling.
You only had 2 days before you came in. You obviously had the sleep specialist and everything. How did everything go? Were you able to catch up on your sleep?
It was kind of hard at first, but coach made sure we had got a lot of rest, you know. But at the same time, we made sure we prepared the right way. So, it was good on both sides.
What's the plan for the bye then? Just to sleep, I guess?
Spend time with family, you know, hang out with friends. But the main thing, you know, just stay even keel, don't get in any trouble, you know, so we can get ready for this long season ahead.
Great stuff from Crow, great stuff from Calvin Pryor, who I thought has been absolutely fantastic so far this year, getting up and helping in the run, blitzing off that right-hand side has been brilliant. And a guy who came in this week, and we'll talk about this with the guys off the back, but he had a dreadful game against the Rams for the Seahawks. He got cut, he gets brought in the building, and well, let's let him tell the story of how he's gone from not being with the team 4 days ago to getting rushed into action today. Here is Dion Bailey speaking with Liam.
Oh man, just a surreal moment. All you can ask for is another opportunity to prove yourself. I mean, my career has really been a whirlwind, and man, God is just good and always on time. So, and I least expected to have another opportunity. I was presented one, and it was in a big time. I'm just thankful I could come through for these guys, man. They've been great to me since I came through the door, open arms to everyone in secondary, everybody on the team, on defense, the coaching staff, everybody's just been helping me along the way, every step.
Can you take us through the camera play that was out of bounds when you guys, he caught up his feet were out of bounds?
I'm just lined up, just tried to do my job. That's it.
Did you think it was coming your way? Because obviously Cameron signaled single coverage and so it looked like you weren't.
Whenever you're in man coverage, always think the ball's coming your way. When you don't think the ball's coming your way, that's when it will and you won't be prepared. So just always play like it is coming your way. Two things I can control, and that's my effort and my physicality. And I try to bring that to the table every time I take the field.
So they claimed you Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
So did you get to...
I got here Tuesday at 5:45 in the morning. I took a red eye Monday night.
Okay. So you knew that they're picking you up. Okay.
Yeah, they claimed me off waiver. They couldn't claim me until Monday because right. They didn't release me till Saturday, and I guess okay. You can't claim on Sundays.
Right, right.
So I had to wait till Monday. My agent told me they claimed me. And, you know, I'm not a big NFL guy. I don't watch a lot of NFL football unless it's an opponent or something. So I didn't really know much about the Jets. I knew a lot about Coach Bowles because he used to be at Arizona, and they're in our conference. I know they rush, and a guy that's real familiar to my style of play is Tony Jefferson, and he thrived in that defense. So as soon as the Jets claimed me, he texted me and was like, man, you're going to be in a great position. Coach Bowles is going to love you. I mean, Tony was the same position I was in. He came out undrafted, and Coach Bowles gave him a shot.
So you took a red eye from Seattle to New York Monday night. Mm-hmm. Your practice Wednesday and Thursday. You need to take a red eye from New York to London.
It's been
what's
a world,
your body clock?
It's been a world. This week, I don't think I'll ever forget this week for the rest of my life. It's really been a crazy week for me, but from the day that I was able to present the opportunity in Seattle to show what I can do, and then things happened in St. Louis that was very uncharacteristic to me. I mean, I just stayed the course and keep believing in myself. Then I was blessed to come here with a group of guys that was so welcoming. You know, some guys may feel threatened or something by a guy not want to help them along the way, but it was a complete opposite in the locker room. And I give as much credit to myself as to the guys in the locker room to my success tonight. I mean, they really helped me be able to be in the right position to make the plays tonight.
When did you realize you're going to London? Because you say you don't really follow the NFL, so was it a big surprise that you were?
Like 30 minutes before I was about to, no, like an hour before I was about to head to the airport, my agent called me like, do you have a passport? I'm like, passport. And he's like, yeah, you guys are going to London. I'm like, going to London? So I had to scramble around to find my passport, because, I mean, I'm not thinking about my passport during the year. That's the off-season things. But gratefully, good thing that in college, one of my teammates, Matt Barkley, he took a couple of us to Haiti to build houses for a village. So I happened to get a passport then, going into my my senior year. So it just worked out. I had the passport, didn't have to scramble to try and get it, get one and get it rushed and whatnot. And I was able to, you know, be prepared to make this trip.
How long did it take you to find it?
We were scrambling because it was panicking, because I thought my mom had took it, and my mom had just left from Seattle like 2 days before, because she took one of my luggages, and I thought I had it in that luggage. But I was able to find it, and I mean, just it's crazy.
You mentioned your teammates in terms of, you've obviously come from Seattle, where people like Sherman and Chance are obviously the best at their position, and people like Rivas and Cromartie as well. How much have you been able to take from them?
It's honestly crazy. Like, I've only been in the NFL, this is only my second year, and I've been blessed to play with two of the best corners to probably possibly ever play the game. I mean, just an abundance of knowledge I've been able to take in, and it's really going to pay dividends to my career in the future.
So lots of positivity from that defense there. I particularly enjoyed at the end the stuff from Deion Bailey. And let's talk about the positivity that came from this Jets defense, because positivity was a word that came out in all of those interviews. Mm-hmm. And Bailey's got to be a better example than anyone else. We saw him against the Rams 2 weeks ago look genuinely dreadful. He got absolutely burnt by Nick Foles. He came into this game, he played a fantastic game. We saw Buster Skrine coming off the edge, doing a lot of rushing. What amazed me about this Jets defense is they've got that powerful front, but I don't think they've got a clear edge rusher. Quinton Coples doesn't do it for me. They've got nobody who can
pace. No,
nobody who can set the edge. They've got people who can set the edge, sorry, but they've got nobody who can actually come off the edge and pass rush. And yet they bring all these packages with Pryor, with Skrine, with these guys coming up and making the blitzes off defensive back.
Skrine was just constant. He was just blitzing all the time.
They blitzed on 80% of dropbacks.
Yeah.
They played zero coverage constantly. They knew that Tannehill couldn't be trusted to get out quickly enough. They knew the left side of that line. Leonard Williams had a phenomenal game against the left-hand side of that line, obviously with the injury out to Brandon Albert. And the Jets now at 3-1, and I was looking at sort of doing power rankings this week and working out, and I've got them not only as a top 10 team, but really anyone below them. There's so much average play in the NFL right now. Below the Jets, I had them in ninth. Below that, it's just 2-2 teams.
Yep.
There are only 9 teams with winning records. The Jets are one of them. And actually, you've got to start thinking about them seriously as the contender to the Patriots in the AFC East, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, if this was heavyweight boxing, they would be the number one challenger right now, wouldn't they? Because Buffalo have had their shot and they've lost. Miami are not being any taken seriously unless something amazing happens with Jim Campbell coming in. So, yeah.
You've even got his name wrong. That's how unmemorable he is. God. Dan Campbell.
Dan Campbell, you're right. So sorry, yeah. Dan Campbell, Dan, Jim, whoever it is. Well, I mean, you know, look, I'm not going to make any pretense about this. He's not a coach who I'm especially familiar with.
No, I had to look up his Wikipedia page.
Yeah,
today.
That's, you know, they're the number one contender in the AFCs. And you know, there's a lot. What's funny is I didn't leave Wembley thinking, wow, they've blown me away, and that's what's happened. I really left thinking that the Dolphins were bad and the Jets were, you know, okay. And that was my question with that, and the reason I wouldn't draw excessive judgments just from one game is that I still think it's crazy that when you're playing this early game, both teams are leaving America on Friday, and I do think that has some impact on the game, because that's a 9:30 a.m. start for these teams coming from the East Coast, and they've had no time to adjust to it.
The thing is, the Dolphins came out and spoke about starting fast. That's all they've spoken about since week one, and they've been outscored 37-3 in first quarters this season. And the man himself, I just wanted to drop it one final time because I'm starting to feel like we can't do it anymore. He wasn't great in the second half, but he had one big bomb on that first drive. Got the touchdown. Well, I think Ivory got the first touchdown, didn't he? And the second one was to the tight end going into the back end when they ran that screen across the front, and he just got completely free in that. I thought that was a great throw from Fitzpatrick. Yep. But all in all, after that point, they just went, We're leading.
Mm-hmm.
We're away from home.
Mm-hmm.
We've got them dominated defensively. Let's just get our big running back to run the ball down the gut and tear them apart. And it was just a great game plan. And Todd mm-hmm. Bowles has really, really impressed me through 4 weeks.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the blitzing, Todd Bowles is exactly the same as last year in Arizona. He is not afraid to bring everything from everywhere, and he's brilliant at it. And he's, I think, got a, you know, a really exciting future as a head coach. I really believe in him. And so I think he's, you know, he's obviously knows what he's doing. I think Chris Ivory, one of the probably more underrated running backs in the NFL that coming into this season, who clearly very capable as long as he's not hurt.
Yeah, that's it. He has some issues, gets knocks, gets, and when you're that physical, it's not really a surprise. He's not a guy who slows down after contact.
Exactly, exactly. But as long as he's healthy, the line is blocking fine. You know, actually, Bilal Powell went out in this game, and he's a different style of runner, but he's also run pretty well when they've asked him to this season. So they'd have another option if he is, if anything were to happen to Ivory. So they run the ball well. They have an aggressive defense. You play that aggressive defense. And, you know, again, we're talking about the opposite almost of what they've done with Sue in Miami, bringing him into a situation where he doesn't make any sense. You've got a great blitzing defense, and you've brought back in Cromartie and Revis. And it's like, great, blitz, and then trust your two stud cornerbacks to make
plays. To play man, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And actually, you know, Jarvis Landry was the one real bright spot for the Dolphins in this game.
Mm.
And actually, we talked about Buster Skrine really closing down on his blitz, but he played in the slot whenever Landry was in there, and actually in the first half kept him out of the game. And most of Landry's plays, he was their leading rusher on the day. A lot of sweeps and end arounds, a lot of yards from punt returns. You know, he looked like their most impressive player, mm-hmm. but I think he was only two or three receptions on the day. The rest of it all came from gadget plays and gimmicks, and that's the times where actually Lazer's offense did get going, when they went through that one guy. But otherwise, I thought Skrine was really good in the nickel as well, and I thought they can cover mm-hmm. with just the most basic. It's cover zero. It's just no deep safety. Bring the house.
Yeah.
Let your corners do their job. And if you can do that, you can beat most
teams. As long as you can get the pressure, it'll work. Like, if you can't get the pressure, then that'll get ugly really quickly. But if you're getting the pressure and they had it all day, then sure.
Let's just before we move on to the rest of the weekend's games, quickly touch on, as I did say, Mike White from the BBC did speak to Alistair Kirkwood after the game about the future of the game over here. Obviously, there's a lot of question marks. Will it be four games next year? What does the Tottenham deal mean? How are they going to attract bigger teams, etc.? So let's hear what Alistair had to say to Mike.
Alistair, thanks for your time. 12 games in now, 12 games down. Where are the NFL at in the UK now? How do you assess this?
Oh, I think we're in a really good place. We're growing all the time. We've got momentum on our side. We've sold out our three games this season. You know, it's only 3 years ago that we were playing one game a year, and now three games seems like the minimum. And, you know, all the questions are, when are we doing more? When are we going to have a franchise? I'm stealing all your future questions here, I think.
But, makes it easier.
Yeah, no, but I think we're you know, really in a great place, and really happy to be on the BBC again. I think that's great for us, both as a stamp of approval, but also bringing in casual fans. You know, so fan growth continues to really grow, and I think people are accepting us as being part of the sporting calendar. And you know, this has been quite a weekend for British sport, and for us to be in the mix and have a sellout crowd, largest attendance of the weekend. That's a big statement.
You've been a big part of this vision from day one, but has anything surprised you about where you are at now, 12 games down the line?
I'm honestly really surprised that we played 12 games. I mean, when we announced the first game, the new Wembley hadn't been opened. Most of my questions that I was being fielded were asking me what new job was I going to go for if it failed, and why were we doing it, and what was the point. And
how much satisfaction does that give you then?
Oh, well, it gives me tremendous satisfaction that the fans have really kind of supported it, you know, because the part of the big unknown is not that the sport itself will entertain and really engage. So, as you've seen yourself, you've got 32 team jerseys represented. You've got people that come and watch these games, even though their teams are playing later and they're probably going to miss how their teams are actually doing. So I'm really surprised that fans are fans of the sport, probably as much as they are of any team, and that they come out and they're kind of really loyal. We've got, 40,000, just under 40,000 people that have season tickets for all three games. That means we have 44,000, or more or less, 45,000 coming as one-offs for, you know, one game each season. And that means that we're getting a really nice balance of people really kind of showing loyalty and yet also turning over new people and introducing it to the sport as a whole. So I can't be more pleased, really.
Final one. You have fielded the question a little bit, so I won't ask it directly about the future of a franchise in England.
You just did.
I did. Yeah. But the Spurs one was the interesting one. The new Spurs stadium, a 10-year commitment, bespoke facilities in the stadium, including the pitch as well.
Yeah.
Is that as big an indication as ever that, come on, there's a future further down the line for a team now?
Well, it's certainly an indication that we're not going away, right, because it's a 10-year deal, and that's a huge statement. It's also a really big indication that we've certainly got ambitions. I think quite honestly, we're still trying to work out exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. The challenge is that we're trying to do something that's never been done before, and we're building up a really good body of record. You know, that I think I'm right in saying that this is something like the 19th team to have come over, the Jets. I think I'm right in saying that. Out of 32, that's a lot. It's a lot of teams, a lot of people that could have moaned and kind of spoken ill of the UK experience, but they haven't, you know, and teams keep coming over and hearing good things. So I think we won't really know for sure exactly how this is going to pan out, but you can take the Spurs deal as an indication that we're here to stay. And, you know, what it actually will end up meaning, we'll find out.
You know what I'm like? I've lied. I'm going to ask one more because I'm picking up on something you've said about the amount of teams that come. So the next question now is then, how do you get a Seattle? How do you get a Green Bay? Those teams, the big teams at the moment that still haven't been yet, how do you get those teams over here now?
Most of it is luck. It's not all design. Some of it you won't be able to do. So Green Bay will never be able to give up a home game.
No.
Then there's a few other teams where their stadium agreements mean that they can't.
But there's visiting teams.
Yeah, but on the other side, I turn it around. You know, Kansas City are in the Guinness Book of Records for the loudest sports audience anywhere in the world. So they have arguably the most passionate or amongst the most passionate of any sports fans. And Kansas City have given up a home game. And, you know, as much as I'm a proponent and supporter of the Wembley experience, that Kansas City experience is not going to be as loud here as it will be over there. And the fact that they're willing to give up a game and in November come over here, it, you know, just shows that things can happen.
Big thanks again to Mike White, genuinely one of the really great, genuine guys who covers the sport. Top bloke, and I beat him in fantasy. So we like him all round. Go and follow him on Twitter at Mike White Sport. Well worth a follow. As I say, really top guy. And great stuff, Alistair Kirkwood, always good value. I mean, he talks in a lot of platitudes. That's his job to do that.
Yep.
But some good stuff in there, particularly on the kind of teams they're trying to get over. He mentioned, obviously, Green Bay in particular as a team they wanted to get over. We asked on Twitter of the 12 teams who at the end of this season will never have played in these international series games, who would you like to see most? The teams, if you're not aware, Cincy, Cleveland, Baltimore, Indy, Houston, Tennessee, Washington, Philly, Green Bay, Carolina, Arizona, Seattle. I thought I rattled that off pretty well.
Thank you very much.
Weirdly, a lot of love for Tennessee, a lot of love for the Eagles, but then outside of that, a lot of Green Bay, a lot of the Colts. It's clear that people want to see the Seattle, of course, as a team, have gone to the Super Bowl twice in this season. But it's all about for people. You know, this guy is a Ravens fan. Baltimore aside, seeing Rodgers do his thing would be a treat for everyone, no matter what shirt you're wearing. Go pack. They're just, I'm reading through it. There's so much love for Rodgers in particular. Rodgers, just to see the best there is, comes in from James Kemp. Interestingly, in terms of the Eagles link, we actually know that the new stadium deal in Cincinnati has a clause that they have to come and play a game out in Wembley. And so James Dixon, formerly of this parish, suggested Eagles play in Cincinnati next year as one of their road games. It's AFC, NFC, which generally is what they like to do.
Yep.
That would be a great matchup next year if the Eagles can get things together.
I was going to say, would we be seeing Chip Kelly's Eagles, or could it be? I don't know who would be in there next if it wasn't Chip Kelly.
If you're to believe Nick Saban, if he doesn't end at the Cowboys, basically, depending on what they do over the next few weeks. So a lot of love on Twitter for that. Should we move on and talk about the weekend's games?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, good. Great.
Although that was one of the weekend's games.
I feel like I've not... All right, mate. Calm your storm. Let's start off with last night. Cam Chancellor punched the ball free from Calvin Johnson at the 1 yard line when it appeared like the Lions.
Pay the man.
We're going to take the lead. And the Seahawks held on for a 13-10 win last night. First of all, on Cam Chancellor.
Yeah.
Since he's been back on the field through eight quarters, 18 drives, one fumble.
Mm-hmm.
One field goal and 16 punts.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That the difference he has made. And okay, they've played some pretty bad offenses, but he has transformed how that defense looks. And we said he was going to when he came back, and I'm delighted he now has. Obviously, what everyone's going to be talking about from this game, though, is going to be the controversy that happened at the end. If you've not seen it yet, we've tweeted out pictures online. When the play itself is phenomenal, Calvin Johnson catches the ball, goes for the line, dives for the line, and as he does, so Earl Thomas came across and made the tackle. It was a great tackle in itself, and probably he might have ended up being short of the line anyway, but as he reached out to the line, Cam Chancellor launched himself Superman style, punched the ball out of his single hand, probably going out of the end zone anyway, and then KJ Wright decides he's just going to bat the ball out of the end of the end zone. Now, if you've seen the picture with where the touch judge, the back end judges stood, he literally couldn't have a better view of it. It's clear he just doesn't seem to know the rules because he even reaches for his flag at one point as if he's thinking about it. What really frustrates me about this and really needs to be looked at is that's not, if you're not familiar with it, by batting out of the end zone, it should have been Lions ball at the point of the fumble. They would have had it on the one, and they would have had four chances to punch it in. Amir Abdullah would look good against this Seattle defense throughout the game. Instead, it's a touchback, which in itself annoys me. Why is a lost fumble anywhere else on the field? If it's not recovered, go back to the team in possession, except if it goes through the back of the end zone, then suddenly it becomes a touchback to the defending team. That in itself annoys me, but the fact is he clearly does bat out of the end zone, but they decide that it's not a reviewable play because what they're reviewing is the fumble. And that's just... You've got all this technology. You've got Dean Blandino, and he's talking to the media afterwards and saying that they've made the wrong call. Yeah. You're sat there in New York watching it, Dean. Yeah. How about picking up the phone and going, actually, guys, let's give the Lions a ball on the one, because otherwise this is all we're going to talk about all week. And look, it's what we're talking about.
Sorry, yeah, I mean,
bad language.
I mean, you've pretty much nailed it all there. I mean, the one bit I disagree with you on, and I don't know why, I think I just am a fan of... The all or nothing nature of it. I kind of like the cruelness of that rule that if you fumble and it goes out the back of the end zone, that's it. It's a touchback. I don't know. I've always...
You're basically a cruel man. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. I've always quite liked that sort of, you know, get it right or you're completely blowing it. But, you know, in terms of the ruling, in terms of the back judge being in exactly the perfect space to see it, you're spot on. And, you know, this is obviously Blandino said that he'd been told by the back judge, whose name is not in my head at the moment.
I did not expect you to know the name of the back judge. I'm not going to lie.
Well, I mean, obviously, I've been, you know, I've read it not many minutes before coming in here, you know, he said he thought it was accidental, but I mean, there's no way that he can have honestly looked at that. I think that's post-rationalized. There's no way you can honestly look at the action that Wright makes with his hand and think that's accidental. What else is he trying to do with that hand that he swings out towards the ball and pushes it with? You know, it's silly because the ball would have gone out. I mean, that was definitely going out for the back of the end zone anyway, so he didn't need to do it. There was no one else anywhere close to being near enough to take it off him. So,
but this is what I'm saying about the back of the end zone. Now, say that that's not a rule. And he has to try and make a play on it. That makes it more interesting. The fact that KJ Wright, once it's been pushed out and fumbled, he's then got to try and make a play on the ball to stop it go out the end of the end zone. That's exciting.
Maybe they should introduce a European football style drop ball. see how that one works out.
Who would you have going up against each other in a drop ball situation, though? Are we talking like defensive tackle against like right tackle, the biggest guys on the field?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. You get two linemen and the referee has to sort of, you know, stand at a good arm's length and just drop the ball between them, and whoever comes up with it has it. No, I mean,
full pile on. That's how we should do it.
we're reaching slightly into the
bundle.
Yeah, all 11 players. Just give it to a fan and let him throw it back into the field and they just have to chase
Aussie
after
rules
it.
Football where the refs like do that kind of crouching down and launch it back over their head.
Yes.
Like when you used to play in goal playing Wembley and you wanted to make it fair that you weren't throwing it to your mates, you just threw it back over your head.
These are all great. We should speak to Blandino. We should get him on the phone. We've got some things to propose.
We have got... The Brits have got some suggestions, guys. And it involves more rules from our sports.
It was silly. And it's, of course, as fate would have it, the same end zone where Seattle got their fail Mary touchdown against Green Bay on Monday night three years ago. And so it's...
The interception.
Yeah, the... that was of course the final act of the replacement refs basically, so at least they were able to blame that one on in lack of knowledge. But
well, that's the best tweet I saw about this was at least the Lions can and the judges who got it wrong can console each other with knowing that neither of them are going to the playoffs this year. Just to look at the game itself, obviously that controversy at the end, but it was a tight game thanks to, first of all, the turnover that won it for the Lions. The Lions offensively were not good enough. Calvin Johnson barely showed up on the day. He had, I think, 5 catches in the end. The touchdown would have made a big difference. But, yeah, well, that's kind of what his records look like this year. Stafford made some half-decent throws, but... He was under a little pressure. Abdullah looked okay, but there were a lot of three and outs and a lot of times where they wasted possessions. But my takeaway was how bad the Seahawks offensive line is. Worse than anyone expected, and we went into the season expecting it to be bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this happens when you trade away your starting centre, doesn't it? And I think it's a funny thing. I was talking about this with someone else recently. No matter how many years I sort of follow this sport, write about this sport... I feel like I'm consciously very aware of how fundamental offensive lines are to being able to succeed. And yet every offseason I still manage to make the same mistakes about thinking a team, oh, well, you know, they lost that lineman, but look, they brought in Jimmy Graham. Hey, that'll work. And it's...
who blocked 0 times.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Went absolutely missing in the game. I mean, Russell Wilson, the Lions defense, who have got a good line, it's definitely a weakened line since last year, but they got 7 tackles for loss, sacked Russell Wilson 6 times, and that's also with Russell Wilson making some ridiculous plays where he rolled out of the pocket, moved around, managed to make a throw. At one point he held onto the ball for something like 7.5 seconds and still managed to be able to complete a pass. And that's not because of protection. Yeah. That was because of his own awareness, his own evasion, because he was brilliant.
I remember...
They're going to have a real problem if they can't protect him. I saw a stat that was... he's had 25 fumbles over the last 2 years, the most for any quarterback. The big thing is they recovered every single one of those last season. Tonight, they had 2 fumbles, lost them both. One of them returned for a touchdown. And if they're not also making the heads-up plays to jump on the ball as well, then actually I think Seattle are in more trouble than we think they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Bengals next week. That's at the Bengals. That's a tough, tough game.
I think it's a fascinating game because we're also at this point now with the Bengals where we're sort of going, well, what if this year they don't start blowing it in the big games? what if they actually just play that way all the time? Which, you know, would be... this is a fascinating test for them. I think that Dalton's absolutely been fantastic through the first month of the season. And so, you know, that... Whatever else about the Seattle team, if the offense is having problems, that defense is still top rate now that Chancellor's back, and so it's going to be a real test of him as well. But yeah, that's a huge game on the.
Let's quickly mention the Bengals this weekend as part of our quick run through games. The Bengals 36, Chiefs 21, 3 touchdowns for Jeremy Hill on the day. Generally, the Bengals relied on their backfield to do most of the work, but Dalton again had a good day protecting the ball, finding AJ Green. The Chiefs' inability to come from behind against good teams and play deep football. Macklin had his best game in about 18 months. I don't know what his final numbers are, but I remember seeing he was 7 for 97 at half time. So they're trying to do more, the Chiefs, but honestly, right now, the fact is they got 21 points off 7 field goals. That's not a team who are going to challenge in the playoffs. And I like them before the season. I think the Chiefs are in trouble, and I really, really like the Bengals.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you're right, obviously, about the not converting red zone opportunities into touchdowns. On the other hand, I sort of find it almost more unsettling that I think that this is an Andy Reid team with, you know, good defenders that doesn't seem to be playing good defense. You know, you think about last season and the pass rush and how good it was, and you think that where's some of that... some of that gone, but yeah, I mean, I think my preseason thought that the Chiefs might have been in position to take advantage of the Broncos, who I assumed were not going to be as good as they are, is all looking a bit wrongheaded at the moment.
Right, let's talk about the other games from Sunday night, and let's rattle through them then. I'd like to say that game next week, Seahawks Bengals, is an absolute cracker. Can't wait for that one. Mm-hmm. The Arizona Cardinals, who the first 3 weeks I was in love with, and I still am. I still think that they're a great team. I love their attacking style, and I'm a big, big Carson Palmer fan. But they came up against their first real test of the year, having played three terrible teams through 3 weeks, and Gurley and Foles send the Cardinals to their first loss of the season, 24-22. And I know this is a game that you watched reasonably closely, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but what were your thoughts on the game?
Wow. My thoughts, probably we could just move on and talk about some. I thought it was sort of weirdly, I mean, not that I predicted it, but when you sort of looked at it with hindsight, you could look at it and think, God, that was almost weirdly predictable. Because, first of all, Jeff Fisher and the St. Louis Rams, they show up in divisional games. They don't show up any other time, but they do show up like crazy in divisional games. The Rams, obviously, last season, a bit of a knack for injuring Arizona Cardinals quarterbacks, so there was no surprise that they were able to get after Carson Palmer very effectively. They did that extremely aggressively all game, got the pass rush, and that, frankly, is the it's potentially an issue that's inherent to the way Bruce Arians likes to play on offense. You know, he wants to wait for these deep balls to unfold and give Carson Palmer time to sit back there. And if you keep doing that against a team who can rush the passer well, you create problems for yourself. But there's an extent to which it's also true that, you know, Bruce Arians had, even at 3-0, there was sort of hammering the team with this sort of message of, you know, you aren't shit. You haven't proven anything yet. You've got to prove a lot more than winning a few games at the beginning of a season. And I think that the Cardinals sort of found that out on Sunday. There were too many lackluster performances right through the team, and Palmer being certainly one of them, because his passing was nowhere near as accurate as it has been through the first 3 weeks. Just a lot of players who didn't play up to their level.
You outgained the Rams 447 yards to 328, and so it's a lack of conversion is a big issue. But I look back and I think about the
players who you trust, like Fitzgerald as well, dropping opportunities that would have changed the game a little bit. But that's how it goes some weeks.
I look at the 2012 Cardinals, I think it was, who started the season going 4-1 and then collapsed to something like a 5-11 record overall. And we were saying at 4-1, wow, this is the worst 4-1 team I think we've ever seen. I don't feel that way about this team. I think you're right. It's a weird divisional game. Mm. And the fact is, the way Todd Gurley showed up in that fourth quarter, fourth quarter alone, 9 carries, 106 yards, and the particular heads up play right at the end, which from what we understand since from both Fisher, from Foles and from Tavon Austin, who was pointing him towards the end zone, is Gurley breaks the line with about 55 seconds left. Mm-hmm. He gets past the first down marker. He knows the Cardinals have no timeouts left. And rather than score his first ever NFL touchdown, he falls on the board, ball 8 yards short, lets himself get touched, and they can take the knee and take the win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he knows that if they go in, they miss the extra point, which is more difficult now.
Exactly.
It's an 8-point game, and Carson Palmer's been impressive. He's got deep threats in the likes of Brown. That's a real heads-up play from a rookie, particularly when he's not been told to do it.
Yeah, and you know, it was funny because we had, just going into the week, we're going to try and get Gurley the ball a little bit more. Well, I think any sort of notion now that it's going to be splitting with Trey Mason and trying to make this some sort of committee has just got to go out the window, because he was fabulous, and I think that needs to definitely be said. And he's it's exciting to see someone come into the league and have to sort of deal with an injury at the start of their career, and you think, oh, how are they going to sort of fare with getting up to speed? But exciting to see them be able to come in and just go straight away. So he's and God, of the Rams needed a running game ever since Steven Jackson disappeared. So there's definitely you know, there's definitely the makings of a really good team in St. Louis, but I feel like I've been sort of saying this for years and banging my head up against the wall, because they've had for 3 years now, maybe one of, if possibly at times, the best defensive front in the league. And with Donald now playing the way he is this season, it's taken it up another level. So it's a ridiculous defensive front. And the problem has always been, well, fundamentally, the problem has always been the offense that fired sort of in fits and starts with Bradford under center. Foles, I actually think, is doing a pretty good job there so far. He's not, and again, we're not talking about the next Dan Marino, Joe Montana, but we are talking about a guy who seems to be able to manage an offense.
Yeah.
And if they can run the ball, then hey, you know, they should be able to beat teams. The problem is, again and again, Jeff Fisher teams do this, show up in division games, and then flip and go and lose to Washington.
Are you familiar with the Time Hop app? Is this something you have on your phone?
I don't have it, but I'm familiar with it.
So I received a Time Hop on Saturday, I believe it was, whenever it was, that was from 2012. And that was the year that obviously the Rams traded for all those picks. Mm-hmm. I think it was also the year they came over to London to play the Patriots, yep, as well. So they decide not to take RG3. They trade, they get all those first round picks. And I actually tweeted you, and I don't know why the conversation happened, but there was a tweet that said, at Paolo Bandini, or whatever your Twitter handle is, go ahead, sell yourself to the people.
It's Paolo _ Bandini. Paolo Bandini was thieved by someone who barely uses Twitter when Twitter first started. Very upsetting.
Unbelievable. Paolo _ Bandini. At Paolo _ Bandini, with Jeff Fisher and all those first round picks and the talent they already have, I see this as a playoff team in 2 to 3 seasons. Mm-hmm. That was my tweet to you, and we're now in exactly the same position 3 years later, where I'm looking at it and going, well, there's loads of talent there, but they're just not putting it together. So come on, Rams, do something interesting, because it's definitely not going to happen from the other team in the NFC West who we haven't talked about and won't talk about. Ollie's not here. I don't have to talk about them.
Oh.
Ollie's not here, and this is what's most bizarre about Ollie not being here. And I mentioned this on the last podcast, but it's worth mentioning again because he's not here to gloat about it. I first met Ollie in April 2012. In that time, the Packers have played the 49ers 4 times before Sunday night, and the 49ers have come out on top every single time. QPR, his football team, have played Reading, my football team, 9 times. 5 draws, 4 Reading wins. He has never beaten me as a sporting fan to another sporting fan when our rivalries have come together, and yet on his first opportunity to gloat, he doesn't bother showing up.
I'm now suddenly getting a little bit suspicious, Will. All this time I've been listening to you saying, oh, you know, where's Ollie? And now I'm beginning to think, doesn't this sound like the protests of a violent criminal protesting too much?
Never. I did never feel that way.
You know, the last time I saw you, Will, you were heading home on Sunday and you were, you know, maybe not as happy and...
Oh, God, yeah. Well,
here
we
watched,
you
are. We haven't slept. Need some energy.
Let's cover off the rest of the games nice and quickly. The one game I wanted to talk about a little bit more depth, because we gave Brady so much love when he did this just a few weeks ago. Drew Brees, with his 400th touchdown pass, hit CJ Spiller with a short pass to the running back, which he took for an 80-yard touchdown, mm-hmm, to give the Saints a 20-26 win over the Cowboys in overtime. They missed a field goal right at the death, mm-hmm, when it looked like they were going to win it. But all in all, the Saints, they were 0-3 going to this game. They go to 1-3. The Cowboys, everyone wanted to say they were going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
They had that big loss to the Falcons last week where they had a big lead. And then they go into New Orleans against a team who haven't been very good, and they lose there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so much a good offensive line can do. We talked about how good offensive line play, mm-hmm, was key, but no Romo, no Dez.
Yeah.
They've now got Lance Dunbar out in the backfield, who's caught a lot of passes out from Brandon Whedon. Mm-hmm. I'm really concerned for the Cowboys at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to shake the feel now that the wheels are coming off. And I was definitely in the camp who thought they'd be all right. I didn't think they were going to win every game or anything, but actually I've picked them in both of the last 2 weeks. I thought they'd beat the Falcons, and they don't have that great start, and I was feeling all vindicated. It fell apart. And this game, you know, and it's not just a good offensive line. They play good defense, by the way, as well, but you need to be able to do more than fundamentally what Whedon was doing successfully, which is swing pass to Dunbar, swing pass to Dunbar, swing pass to Dunbar. And when that went as well, there was really nothing left. And it's, you know, it's hard not to feel sorry for them, because you can lay whatever plans you want, and I don't think there are many teams in the NFL that could lose their best quarterback, their best receiver, and, you know, a useful player out of the backfield and continue to win games. So in a sense, the fact they're even fighting these games close is a testament to how much good there is there. I do think it will probably end up seeing, just because of the desperation to try and keep this season alive long enough for Roma and Bryant to come back, I think we'll probably see Castle now sooner rather than later.
What they could really do with at this point is a nice easy run of games to kind of alleviate the pressure on them. Particularly Sean Lee also went out of the game with it. I'd say Sean Lee, Des Bryant and Tony Roma are their three best players so far this season. Sean Lee goes out with a concussion. We think he's going to be back. To be fair, they get Rolando McLean and Greg Hardy back this week from their relative suspensions. That could be big for them. But they only have to play the Patriots this week. And then the best team in football right now. And then travel to the Giants next week, who have really started to put it together in the last couple of weeks. And then play the Seattle Seahawks, who have been to the last two Super Bowls. So the next three games, there's a real chance this team are going to be 2-5 in 3 weeks' time, unless they pull something major out. Yep. And that's the sort of hole that in the NFC East you may not get out of.
Well, having said that, is the NFC East not a division that could end up with someone winning it at 9-7?
8-8.
Yeah.
Ugly, ugly. I think the Giants actually were going to come out of that division with a winning record at this point.
Yeah.
I've become really positive on them in the last 2 weeks. And that's because this week they travel to Buffalo, a game that many people expected them to lose, and pull out the win 24-10. A lot of this was to do with Buffalo's own mistakes. A lot of drop passes. They missed Sammy Watkins in a big way. But Rashard Jennings, 51-yard touchdown midway through the fourth quarter, put them 24-10 up. The Bills had no answer to that whatsoever. And most importantly, Manning goes 20-35, 212 yards and 3 touchdowns through the air against the Bills defense, which 2 weeks of this year has looked like the best defense in the league, and the other 2 weeks in this year has been thrown all over and has not managed to get pressure on. And they're the most confusing defense, and they need to really get it locked down in Buffalo, because they've, again, one of those teams have got all the talent in the world and just aren't doing it at the moment.
Well, they did sort of successfully get Odell Beckham effectively out of the game. He really didn't have much of an afternoon, and that was what was interesting about it, is you sort of feel like Rex had drawn up this this game plan to stop him from having a huge impact, but forgot to account for everybody else.
Well, I feel like this is one of those interesting ones where we've got those teams at the moment who, whoever the second receiver is in New York, is always going to get an opportunity if they're going up against the team with one good corner, and that's what the Bills have in Stephon Gilmore. And I'm not slagging off, the rest of their backfield is good, but Gilmore is a level above everyone else. I think if you're playing the Falcons, you've got Trufant, who is a level above everyone else.
Yep.
So Vontae Davis, a prime example. A number one receiver can get taken out of the game, but as long as you're confident that you've got a decent tight end, a decent number two, a running back who can catch the ball out of the backfield, then you can make hay on some of these teams, even so. Let's rattle through the other games, and if there's anything we need to particularly mention, let's do it. We've got a few questions on Twitter as well, and then Paolo, if you have anything that you wish to add to the conversation, I'm opening that up to you now, so get thinking.
Okay.
Because I'm expecting something big. One of the games definitely on paper I was excited about watching this weekend, and it came up as being one of the better games of the weekend as well, was the Broncos-Vikings game. Brandon McManus kicked a 39-yard field goal with 1:51 left, and Denver had 7 sacks in the Broncos 23-20 win over the Vikings on Sunday. And we've said it again and again and again and again. That Denver defense is so legitimate that they could carry old man Peyton at least deep into the playoffs, if not all the way to the Super Bowl, depending on what point they come up against the Patriots, basically.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, I was having this conversation with Sherry at the London game, because as I'm sure listeners are aware, Matthew Sherry, not shy about his love for the Patriots and his feelings on Tom Brady being the greatest quarterback ever to have played. And it's just fascinating that this could be the one year, to be honest with you, that we get to see this idea of Manning playing on a team where it really isn't about him. And if they were to go through and win everything with him not being the star of the show, would sort of reinforce the point that, you know, the quarterback is the most important position in the field, but that isn't what wins you the Super Bowl all of the time. It's having the other things.
Well, it's John Elway's 2 Super Bowls at the end of his career that led entirely on the run game, and he's the man there running this team now. And the run game prior to this week didn't get going. This week, Ronnie Hillman goes over 100 yards. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, one of that was on one big 72-yard touchdown play, but it's going to be hard for them to keep handing
C.J. Anderson the ball when he's doing that.
No doubt. I'm very glad that in the two leagues I picked up C.J. Anderson, I also took Ronnie Hillman in both of those leagues. Very, very glad. Yeah. No, sorry, Fantasy Talk's boring. Sorry, I've scrubbed that off entirely. this game looked tighter than it was, thanks to Adrian Peterson and a 48-yard touchdown of his own where he managed to break through the line. What's amazed me for Denver is, just to make a quick mention, is that I said when Wade Phillips came in this offseason, I thought Von Miller could break the sack record this year under a Wade Phillips scheme. I thought he'd be that good. But you know the guy who's been amazing has been? DeMarcus Ware has just played absolute lights out. I think he's having the best season of his career. Mm. And every play, even the ones where, you know, it was Von Miller falling on the ball, when it was someone else getting a sack, it seemed to be Ware who was being the one to really disrupt them. And he's looked brilliant so far this year.
Mm.
That's my thoughts. Rams-Cardinals, we've talked about. Chargers-Browns. This was a game which surprised many of us. Final score, 30-27. A second chance due to a penalty. Josh Lambeau kicked a 34-yard field goal as time expired. And as the Browns lost in the most Browns way humanly possible. Lambeau wide right on the 39-yard attempt, but Tremont Williams was whistled for offside. Lambeau hit his third field goal of the game with the follow-up. The Browns are tied at 27 apiece on Josh McCown's one-yard pass to Barnage, who's having a ridiculous season for a guy I'd never really heard of before this year, with 2 minutes 9 to play and a 2-point conversion pass. Rivers had a phenomenal day, 23 for 38, 358 yards and a touchdown, despite the fact that his protection wasn't too great. And I feel like they could be carried into a wild card spot, because sneakily Rivers is playing as one of the best two or three quarterbacks in the league, and we're not talking about it.
Yeah, he's sort of been doing that for a couple of years, to be honest with you, though. I mean, Philip Rivers has always been a very, very good quarterback who doesn't, well, I'd say not since the very beginning of his career, actually gets talked about that much. I had thought at the beginning of the season there was going to be a window for someone else to win the AFC West, and, you know, who knows, it's still possible that the Chargers could push really hard and later in this season accelerate beyond the Broncos. But right now, they definitely look like the contender to the Broncos. As you say, they've got a quarterback. They've got Melvin Gordon coming on in the running game. A bit worried about that defense, because I'm not sure that anyone should be giving up that many points to the Browns. But, you know.
Specifically the Josh McCown-led Browns.
I know. Josh McCown gives them the best chance to win now.
So there was a game in San Francisco. It wasn't great. Final score, 3-17. And in fact, actually, from a defensive standpoint, I thought the 49ers put up a decent game. Aaron Rodgers, it required him making one of the most ridiculous heads-up plays of the weekend to finally find Richard Rodgers in the end zone for the opening touchdown. He scrambled out of not one, not two, but three separate tackles on the pass rush down in the red zone to complete that pass. It was just ridiculous. And overall, he just continues to not make mistakes, continues to not get picked off, continues to look absolutely phenomenal. But overall, I thought the 49ers on that side of the ball played reasonably well. Mm-hmm. Just Colin Kaepernick's a hot mess. Complete lack of awareness, terrible offensive line. He was hit on more than half of his dropbacks and sacked six times, and he had to take a lot of stick for that. There is one point I'd like to make, and that's Clay Matthews. Calm the F down. We know he's not Russell Wilson. We know he's not brilliant. You don't need to point it out. If you play phenomenally against a great quarterback, I have no problem with you getting in his face. Getting in the face of Colin Kaepernick because you've managed to sack him twice is like spitting on a puppy. It's not big, it's not clever, it doesn't do anything for you, and you've been one of the most overrated linebackers in the league for about the last 5 years anyway, by your 2010 season, which was phenomenal, I'll give you that. You were outside linebacker, you were massively overpaid. Inside linebacker, you've looked better, but still not that great. I don't like you, Clay Matthews. Get out my face.
I have some empathy with the position of not trolling someone necessarily. Having said that, I mean, when you talk about players who are overrated based on one good season, is Colin Kaepernick not close to a definition of that?
Here's the drunken rant I had at Ollie on Facebook on Sunday night. Ollie said something to me like, this was last night, in fact, watching that game. He said, Wilson's not Kaepernick, which was obviously a tip of the hat to what he said. And I mean, well, do you know what? Clay Matthews is neither Patrick Willis nor Navarro Bowman. And do you know who else he's not? KJ Wright, Bobby Wagner, or Bruce Irvin, all of whom played for the team that beat them in the NFC Championship game last year, and all of whom are better than him in the position, and I got very angry about it. I think I'm done now.
Okay.
My team are terrible.
Do we need to move on?
How long are we going to keep saying the Jaguars have got a shot at being a decent team in this league?
I'm not going to say it at all after that.
105-year-old Matt Hasselbeck, who hasn't played in 73 seasons, comes in and beats them 16-13, and they miss key field goals. Kicking was a huge issue this weekend in general. 14 missed kicks in all the games, which is such a ridiculously high number. But the Jags gained 431 yards. Bortles looked great in the first half. Alan Hearns picking it up big. TJ Yeldon playing great. And they just couldn't sustain it. And they couldn't push on. And at home against a Colts team who have lost their quarterback right before the kickoff, you've got to win that game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a game that, you know, you think that, and doubly so because they are in the same division. You know, it is a game that you have to win so that you can make the statement that we are making progress. Because to make progress in your division, you have to be able to beat the best teams in your division. The Colts have been that for a long time. They're playing as badly as they have played in years. They are missing their starting quarterback. You are not going to get an opportunity like it. And they didn't take it. And yes, fine, we can talk about the yards they made and all the positives. But I feel like, again, in this much the same way as with St. Louis, where we sit here and say, oh, they're just a couple of years away from turning things around. That's been a couple of years now for Jacksonville that they're building and they're going somewhere. And in the NFL, the success, really successful teams don't actually spend 2 or 3 years turning themselves around. They just get on and turn themselves a bloody around, a bit like it appears that the Jets might do under Todd Bowles. So I'm not climbing back onto the Jaguars could start moving bandwagon until I see something a lot better than this.
Now there were other games that were in a very similar vein to that this weekend, where we watched them and we said, sorry, hold on. I'm just going to pause it for a second because I just lost all my stuff. So another game which very much falls into the mold of a missed opportunity. The Eagles lose at home to Washington and continue to look an absolute mess and don't get the run game going again. Kirk Cousins looked okay, surprisingly, after his terrible, terrible game against New York. Sam Bradford looked absolutely lost in the first half. But when your weapons are Miles Austin and whoever, I had such high hopes for this Eagles team.
Yeah.
Do we need to say any more?
No.
The game I was most excited going to in the weekend, because I thought the Raiders might actually manage to go 3-1, was the Chicago Bears against the Oakland Raiders. Jay Cutler came back from his hamstring injury, somehow led them to a 22-20 victory. Not a good game of football, not particularly exciting to watch. And the big thing this week is that the Raiders didn't get going on offense in the same way they had in recent weeks. If Amari Cooper and Latavius Murray aren't having big games, they're not winning games. And you can't have that week in, week out, unfortunately. You've got to rely on your supporting cast a bit. The Raiders don't have a supporting cast.
I think the real talking point of this game is what Martellus Bennett said in the locker room afterwards when someone asked him about Jay Cutler getting stick. And his response was that people threw rocks at Jesus.
Oh God! I don't know. Like, I know it's a joke, but
so many Jay Cutler Jesus parallels to be drawn. I mean, it's
God. I hate that man. The Houston Texans traveled to the Atlanta Falcons and were an embarrassment. Devontae Freeman just dominated this game for the beginning, scoring 3 touchdowns for the second week running. A 48-21 victory. Arian Foster came back first play, caught a 15-yard swing pass, looked like out of the backfield, looked really impressive. Then lost a fumble with the next play and barely played for the rest of the game. Falcons are 4-0 for only the fourth time in the franchise history. And I we've said it week in, week out, I really, really like this Falcons team. They just need to come up against a really good opposition. And I think that they've got lucky with when they played the Cowboys. And other than that, they've played pretty bad teams in the right spots. I think they'll come up against better teams. They look like one of those teams who are going to go like 14-2, but then go out in the divisional round of the playoffs because they suddenly come up against a team who've actually had to play good teams this year.
Well, it's sort of been the same story, I think, with Carolina, and that's the funny thing, that division. You've got two teams that are jumping out who I don't know that they've beaten anyone that we should be excited about yet. So we'll see what happens when they play each other, and we'll see what happens when they finally do get those games against other teams that are worth that are playoff contenders.
However, Matt Ryan does deserve some love. I think he was brilliant again this week.
And Matt Ryan has through the lean years remained a very good quarterback. He is a very good quarterback,
and you can only beat the teams in front of you, and yada yada yada. So you've got to, I guess, give them a little bit of love. And the final game of the week, and I feel like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers have been the final game of the week a number of times. Cam Newton threw for 2 touchdowns, and Josh Norman returned one pick as well as picking off the ball a second time as they beat the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 37-23. The big thing is, I feel like we've said it again, but when you're throwing two touchdown passes to Ted Ginn Jr., you've got to be doing something right if you're doing that well with that team around you.
Yeah, it's extraordinary the lack of receiving options that they have in Carolina, and to be winning games without that. Yeah, I mean it's amazing.
Great. That's kind of got us through the week. Do we just want to see, are there any good questions on Twitter? I'm just going to check this out because we have gone incredibly long with all our interviews, etc. And I now haven't slept for about 30 straight hours. So this is going to be fun. is there a coach hierarchy after the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, like QB line receiver, then lowly tight end coach, for example? I think that might be a dig at Miami. Do you think so?
just a tiny one.
I don't even feel the need to answer that question. Simon's asked, has the extra point change backfired? More pressure on kickers has equaled more missed field goals and more games being decided by kickers.
That's an interesting thought. It depends whether you view that as a backfiring or not. I mean, I'm sure that probably there are lots of NFL teams that the non special teams players who feel like they would rather the game all came down to what happened on offense and defense. That said, if you're going to have a kicker in the game, why shouldn't games be decided?
I love the extra point rule. I'm totally behind it. I literally couldn't be backing it more. So no, I'm absolutely all in on that. And then Dave Cheeseman will just finish off with this one. Who will be the next head coach to lose his job? He suggests Chip at 1-3. I feel like it's too early for Chip Kelly.
Yeah.
I got into the same conversation with Bill O'Brien. I think Bill O'Brien could go 2-14 this year, and they'll give him a chance with a quarterback at the top of the draft.
Mm.
Ideally, Hackenberg, the guy that he brought through at Penn State.
Mm.
And then if he can't win with his guy and another year, then that's when you sack him. And I think it's just too soon. The Chip experiment doesn't feel over to me yet.
This may be ridiculously premature because he has just got the job, but I think just the whole nature and feel of the situation in San Francisco, is Tom Sula possible? He doesn't even last 1 year and that's it?
I think there was always a chance that he was coming in almost as an interim head coach for the year, and they maybe got somebody else in mind, but with the talent they've got there at the moment, it needs a complete overhaul. This feels like 2002, 2003 all over again. You lose 8 of your defensive starters. That's definitely a possibility.
Mm.
I feel like it'd be unlikely we lose another head coach in the season.
Yeah, mid-season's unlikely. But to be honest with you, this is, changing a head coach in the middle of a season, you can only really do that if you've given up on the season. And so, to me, that's what that Miami change says. It says that in 4 weeks into a season, when we basically already invested so much that our salary cap's going to be a nightmare in the next few years, we're giving up. Because you can't install a new playbook and do everything you need to do to be successful as an NFL team in a bye week. You need a lot more than that. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we will see another change until the end of the season. But of course, there's more bye weeks coming up. But it's not like we expect every year to lose a bunch of head coaches in the middle of the year.
My thought on the Miami thing is, it's not the sacking of Joe Philbin that suggests to me they've given up on the season. It's the appointment of Dan Campbell.
Yeah.
If they've gone out, and I said it already, but they've gone out and got a Jim Schwartz, they've gone out and got, I don't know, even a Mike Smith, even a, you know, there are guys out there who have experience, who have had winning teams, who have gone to the playoffs, who bring a culture change. Because the biggest problem in Miami seems to be the culture. It's not a winning culture. They're not going out and starting fast. They're not going out and being strong. And to kind of round off the podcast, starting Miami, ending Miami, I see only negativity going forward. I'm sorry, Clancy, but I just can't see you suddenly turning this around with Dan Campbell as your head coach.
No, unfortunately not. I mean, I'm not sure even if they bring one of those guys you talk about. Not that they aren't good coaches, it would make a difference next season. I just don't know that you can install a playbook in that time and make it work.
Well, it's been fun. This was a proper deep NFL conversation.
Yeah.
We got into it. Yeah, I hope that the people who normally tune in for nonsense still enjoyed themselves.
I tried. I brought along a can with a special.
I haven't actually finished this off. It's quite tasty, though. Do you want to try it?
I'm not sure.
It's probably just my backwash left, to be honest. But yeah, I might
go home to bed at this point.
They can find you on Twitter, Paolo_Bandini.
Yep.
You're also going to be on Americanage tomorrow.
Yeah.
You're going in to do that tonight with the guys. I really enjoyed that last week. I'm sure you will as well this evening. Check Paolo out on the Guardian website and everything else. He does good work.
Cheers. nice of you to say.
Not bigging yourself up, are you, Paolo?
I'm brilliant, and you should stop listening and reading anyone else and just read what I have to say and maybe send me a few envelopes with money in.
Just a reminder that you can check us out on Twitter at Gridiron. Go to sportstraveltours.com if you're thinking about doing any trips out to the US, go and see any games, because they give you the best packages and the most interesting packages, and you get to meet players, and they just give you a real experience for a very good price. Website gridiron-magazine.com. Matt Sherry's article is up there now today, and our Pick'ems game is there as well, ready for the Thursday night game, which is, I think it's a good one this week. I was trying to remember what it is now. The Thursday night game, which is Colts at Texans. I lied, it's not a great game. So we'll be back with another podcast on Friday. We'll preview all the weekend's games. We'll talk about that Colts Texans game as well. Just give me a quick pick.
I'm just distracted by the thought of, if luck doesn't go again, the 100-year-old Matt Hasselbeck running away from JJ Watt just sounds like a recipe for disaster. But I mean, the Colts will probably win, because the Texans just seem not to be capable of winning football games.
Yeah, I'm with you. Andrew Luck's back, Colts win. Yeah. Andrew Luck's not back, Texans win. Yeah. Good. Thank you very much for listening. This has been the Gridiron Show. Enjoy your football this couple of days, because it's all starting again on Thursday. Woohoo!